that's what happens with these, you know, remember the worst boss you've ever had. Oh, they can remember it. Trust me. Oh, right? Yeah. The suffering continues. They still have some trauma around.
Yeah, you can be talking to somebody near retirement age, and their example is from somebody that they worked for in high school.
100%.
And they still remember how this person did not treat them with dignity, 100%. And it stuck with them 50 years later.
Welcome again to It Doesn't Take a Genius, conversation with introspective perspectives and pithy points of view. Here are your hosts, my friends, Max and Marty.
I think that's Mark and Mike.
Yeah, whatever.
Silent. There we go.
Oh, okay.
Now we're good. This is going to happen. Good. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. In.
Ramsey!
Marshall, what a pleasure to see you in person. It's incredibly intimidating, to be honest with you.
That was too much eye contact.
It sure was.
Yeah.
Let's keep looking that way.
Yeah, camera. Let's look at the camera.
For those not on YouTube, we should tell our audio listeners, both of you, that we are in person, in the same city at the same time. Last time we tried to do this, it was a giggle fest and went nowhere for about 10 minutes. This time it was a dumpster fire for about 2 minutes. So we're getting better, but we recorded the whole first segment with a muted mic, and you know that's about the level of professionalism you have here. So,
and I know some of you out there are very excited about the prospect of a muted mic.
That's good.
Oh, that was good right there. Oh, the comedy gold.
I'm going to move on.
Okay, you should.
Okay, so I told you I came prepped. I mean, I got notes, folks. I got show notes for this one.
You used actual toner and ink.
Well, funny you mentioned that, because my hotel, I printed out this at the hotel. Mm-hmm. And it got printed out on things that already had stuff printed on it. And I said, I think somebody's messed with your paper. And sure enough, every single page was already printed on. And so they fixed that for me. And then we realized that the ink was not working either. Hmm. So they went to fix that for me. And then they found out from the general manager of the hotel that they were getting a new printer. And so there was no option. So they had to print it personally for me from the desk. So,
oh, man.
You know how this it is.
You're VIP.
Kind of a customer service story, really.
It is. That is a nice customer service story.
And that's theoretically at least half of what we do here, right? Customer mm-hmm. experience, employee engagement. I think those are the big things in the leadership development sphere that we do. And I'm going to come back to something today that hits on both of those. And we've done a three-parter on this. I went back and looked. We did a three-parter on the concept of dignity.
Yes.
And I remember, you know, specifically you were like, make it make sense to me. I don't get this one book. It was Donna Hicks's Leading with Dignity. You were not as impressed with, well, I don't know that that's fair, but you were like, you know, make it relevant.
I wasn't sure what I could do with it.
Right, right.
Yeah. I love the idea.
Right.
And I believe in it. Wasn't sure how I could bring it to the world.
You're pro-dignity.
Yeah. Just go on the record, pro-dignity.
Well, so I was thinking about that as I was reading, no surprise here, Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, I assume the finest book ever written by an American.
Booker T. Washington!
I mean, and this is, I'm just telling you folks, this is, we're not done mining for gold from Up From Slavery. I mean, there are so many good things about Up From Slavery. But I got some bits on dignity that I wanted to share, because it really is practical. I mean, it is truly practical in how you interact with your fellow workers, your customers, people that frankly are rude, we'll see how far we go with this, but I just have to share this story because I think it's insane. Just insane.
Awesome. Prepare for insanity. That will probably be our bit clicky title.
Sure.
Booker T goes insane.
I do wonder if he would get canceled today. But that's, you know, you'll see what I mean as we go through this. So so here's the deal. First off, let's get it on the record. Booker T. Washington was a black man. He was a freed slave. He became an incredibly successful American. He went up from slavery all the way to, you know, kind of hobnobbing with some presidents and having influence on the world stage. And there's a sort of a reconciliation, a conciliatory tone that he takes through his autobiography. But well aware, he is very well aware that America is racist toward Negroes, all right, as he would have said it. And so there's a scene in the book just that caught my attention. He's in charge at the Hampton Institute, which is the school that trained him and where he first was teaching. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about this the last time we talked about Booker T, that there was this idea that labor was something that was that had dignity, frankly. There was dignity in labor, and that was part of how they could overcome prejudicial treatment. So he learned all that at the Hampton Institute. And while there, he was put in charge of a program where they were taking Native Americans and giving them some education. And he has many, many things to say about that. We're not going to have time to cover it here. But here's the funny incident that just shows how racist things were. So he had to transport a sick Indian boy back to Washington, D.C., so that he could be transported back to the reservation that he came from because he was sick. And so he says that on this journey, he goes by steamboat. The bell rings for dinner. He's a smart man. He's wise. He waits for everybody else and doesn't want to cause any issue where he looks like he's causing problems because he knows that it's a racist system. And after they finish their meal, he goes in with the young Indian. And the man in charge politely informed me that the Indian could be served, but that I could not.
Wow.
He says, I could never understand how he knew just where to draw the color line, since the Indian and I were about of the same complexion. The steward, however, seemed to be an expert in the matter. So it happened again at a hotel. The Indian can stay at a hotel, but you can't, Booker T. Washington. So he in that similar vein, he later tells a story of going to this town where he's everybody's all up in arms, and like he thinks, you know, there might be a lynching. And the issue was that there was this dark-skinned man who tried to check in at the local hotel. And everybody calmed down when they realized that the dude was Moroccan. He was it was a Moroccan who could speak English.
We serve Moroccans. Yeah, Moroccans, definitely welcome.
But the best part is that the Moroccan after that found it prudent. It says he found it prudent after that to not speak English. So the guy had to act more foreign than he was so that the white people wouldn't get all crazy about this, you know, black guy getting uppity.
Yeah, we can't discriminate against him. He's not from around here.
Right.
This makes so much sense. The logic is impeccable here. It's hard to refute.
So some customer service moments there, right?
Yeah.
So all of that to say this. Like, I mean, this is in his autobiography. He knows that it's a racist system. At the very beginning of the whole thing, he relates, you know, his childhood. And this is how he talks about his father. He says, "Of my father, I know even less than of my mother. I do not even know his name. I have heard reports to the effect that he was a white man who lived on one of the nearby plantations." And we know what that means, right?
Mm-hmm.
"Whoever he was, I never heard of his taking the least interest in me or providing in any way of my rearing. But I do not find a special fault with him. He was simply another unfortunate victim of the institution which the nation unhappily had engrafted upon it at that time. My poor dad, who, you know, was unwilling to acknowledge a black son and probably raped my mother, just an unfortunate victim of this institution." So that was the first thing that caught my attention, but I had to give you all the racist stuff so that you could hear, like, you know, like right from the get-go, he's like, yeah, this thing really hurt a lot of people, hurt a lot of white people. That's at the front of the whole autobiography.
That's amazing.
I'm like, what? You know?
The amount of empathy, the forgiveness.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, everything that goes with that. Wow.
100%. So I kept that in my mind as I'm reading the whole thing. Like, you know, what is going on here? How does he justify that with just a little phrase and then moves on to his next point? And so I got to another section, and we talked about this gentleman last time. He had a mentor who was the son of missionaries in Hawaii, who was a Civil War hero, who was the founder, I believe, of the Hampton Institute, where Booker T. was trained, General Armstrong. And so General Armstrong later in life comes to visit Tuskegee Institute, where Booker T. has, you know, created this, you know, what will become a dynasty, you know, just an American institution. And so he has some things to say about it. He says, "The first visit which General Armstrong made to Tuskegee gave me an opportunity to get an insight into his character such as I had not before had." And he says it's what he means by that is his interest in the Southern white people. He had assumed that General Armstrong would harbor some resentment, you know, having fought against the Southern white man, that maybe he cherished a feeling of bitterness toward the white South. And found out that really, he was not. He said, "What Booker T. observed General Armstrong do was that he was as anxious about the prosperity and the happiness of the white race as the black. He cherished no bitterness against the South and was happy when an opportunity offered for manifesting his sympathy." He says, "I never heard him speak in public or in private a single bitter word against the white man in the South." And so he said, from that moment on, he learned a lesson that great men cultivate love and that only little men cherish a spirit of hatred. I learned that assistance given to the weak makes the one who gives it strong, and that oppression of the unfortunate makes one weak." So I got a little bit more here of a quote, but Armstrong set the tone. Armstrong, completely conciliatory himself,
right,
and ready to go there. So,
well, you think about how rare that is, you know, because right. I know people who truly cherish their bitterness.
Mm-hmm. Right? 100%.
They make it the bitterness, the resentment, the centerpiece of their table of life.
Exactly,
I mean, it's just right there in the middle, and it's all consuming. And the things that they are bitter about pale in comparison right. to the slavery and war and right. oppression and, you know, just yeah. like they're minor indiscretions, but they're clinging to them with great fervor.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, holding on to hurt, you know, like it maybe came from a good place even, you know, the, you know, you really hurt me, you really hurt these people, and making that an attack. You know, using that negative emotion as an attack, as a weapon, and so Booker T. says, "I'll have none of that." And so here's the quote.
Wow.
So his lesson was that he resolved that I would permit no man, no matter what his color might be, to narrow and degrade my soul by making me hate him. Mm-hmm. "With God's help, I believe that I have completely rid myself of any ill feeling toward the Southern white man for any wrong that he may have inflicted upon my race." And says, "I pity from the bottom of my heart any individual who is so unfortunate as to get into the habit of holding race prejudice." Now, this is not actually a podcast episode about racism. The thing that caught my attention, Mike, was this little bit here where he says, "If I hate him, it narrows and degrades my own soul."
Mm-hmm.
So here's where all this connects with the dignity stuff. He says, "The more I consider the subject, the more strongly I am convinced that the most harmful effect of the practice to which the people in certain sections of the South have felt themselves compelled to resort in order to get rid of the force of the Negro's ballot is not wholly in the wrong done to the Negro, but in the permanent injury to the morals of the white man." He says, "The wrong to the Negro is temporary, but to the morals of the white man, the injury is permanent." So imagine this, where someone is getting mistreated. Booker T. says, "Yep, that mistreatment happened. It's real, and it's temporary, but the effect on the person doing the mistreatment, it's a permanent injury to the morals of that person." He gives examples. You know, the white men at the time would perjure themselves to try to get blacks, you know, disenfranchised, get them unable to cast a ballot. He said those people would go on to be dishonest in other areas of their life. He says that they would cheat Negroes, you know, in business and so on. Well, they would end up cheating the white man. They would lynch Negroes. And by golly, they would use violence against white men eventually. You know, that these people just got ensnared in, you know, I'll call it a sin. You know, they got ensnared in this treating people like they didn't matter who did matter. You know, that's the definition of a violation of dignity. You know, I'm treating you like you ain't worth nothing. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, it was really the person who did the indignity who was hurting as badly, if not more, according to Booker T., than the person who got mistreated.
Oh yeah, and we hear that today, where you know people talk about that if somebody is hating you,
yeah,
it's not a reflection of you. It tells you everything that you need to know about them.
Hard to take me seriously when I'm this strong.
Yeah, you're having your Chick-fil-A.
you're right. Yeah,
and you know, you've heard that emotionally healthy people do not hate other people. Emotionally healthy people do not bully other people. They don't steal from other people. It's only people who are struggling with their own sense of self, their own dignity, their own securities. Those are the people who find excuses to treat other people poorly.
Yeah, I think that's really 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 wise, and it ties to the Donna Hicks material. So that for those that haven't watched our three-part episodes, we'll link to the show notes, link to it in the show notes. But the quote that I really liked from her work was, "We all want to be treated in ways that show we matter, and when we are not treated this way, we suffer." And the flip side, she says, is also true, that when we make somebody suffer, we ourselves suffer as a result. It violates the whole system. So that's her real point, is that people have to be treated as if they matter. I think because they do. Ooh. I think that's the whole point, is that actually people do matter, and that's what we're, you know, I think most of our work sort of revolves around making sure that employees show customers that they matter, that bosses show employees that they matter, various corporations show the people in the corporations and the departments in the corporations that they matter. And when they don't, they're hurting people, but they're the ones paying the price. You know, they are the ones having a suffering of their own.
Oh yeah. And how many times have we told managers, because managers are like, well, then I can't get on my people. I can't correct them. No.
Yeah.
No, we have a saying, you can be direct with respect.
That's right.
And so yeah, you can address the issue, you can address the performance issue, you can address the thing that's going on. You just don't have to demean the dignity of the person across from you that's receiving it. If you treat them like a human being, but you're direct and you're clear about what the expectation is and right, the consequences, that's perfectly fine. You just don't have to yell and scream to do it.
That's it. That's it exactly. And we'll link to some of Donna Hicks' material, but I'll just quickly go through. She has 10 elements, 10 ways that you can honor dignity. And it's the acceptance of identity, you know, letting somebody be their real self, regardless of, you know, race and so on. Recognizing them, giving them recognition for work that they've done. Acknowledging them, you know, just acknowledging that they exist and have opinions and have things that have happened to them in the workplace. Inclusion. She talks about belonging, you know, making them feel like they're belonging. But I would go so far as to say, you know, sometimes it's inclusion on what's going on, just very simple things, you know, like people that feel like they're left in the dark. You know, that's not inclusion. You know, so just keeping people updated is a simple example. Safety is another one. And of course, safety could be physically. I mean, I've had workplaces, I don't know about you, but, you know, where that's been an issue, you know, where the lighting is bad or the training is bad and people are not safe. And I've also had psychological safety be an issue. Fairness, treating people justly and respectfully. Independence, letting them make some decisions. I think we'd call that empowerment. Mm-hmm. Understanding, you know, that you're spending time trying to get to know where they're coming from. giving them the benefit of the doubt. Mm. That's a big one. And then accountability. And accountability meaning I'm going to be accountable to you when I've done something that violates the dignity. And she has 10 temptations for dignity too, but let's stop there. And does anything from that list grab you as something we just, you know, we keep running into these?
It's all we talk about. It's 100% of all we talk about when we talk about coaching and leading and caring for your people and getting to know them and making sure that you recognize them and provide them feedback and make sure that they're informed. Yeah. Right? Yeah, we preach this. We give people specific tips on how to do these very specific things.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, that there are some specific actions you can take. I'm not saying you can fake it and it works out for you, but there are really specific things you can do, such as, you know, like we talk about management by walking around. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could do that in a fake way where you just walk around and, you know, make people feel like you're looking over their shoulder. Well, that's not honoring dignity. But if you did it with the point of, I'd like to get to know my people a little bit better. Mm-hmm. I'd like them to know that I'm listening to what's going on. Well, my goodness, guess what? You've just honored dignity and raised the value of your workplace, frankly. Mm-hmm. So, 10 temptations to dignity. So this is what you can do that will violate dignity. And some of these, I think, overlap a little bit, but take the bait. You know, you violate my dignity, I'll violate yours. I'm gonna go tit for tat with you. Save face. I'm going to pretend like that didn't really happen. I'm gonna just hold back and not let on that, you know, there's something I've done that might be an issue. Shirking responsibility. You know, I'm not gonna own the things that I've done that are a problem. Seeking false dignity. This is a good one. So I want approval from my boss or from people around me. So I'm going to get validation, feel like I matter by some external circumstances, external influences. Yeah, instead of knowing that I just have dignity. You know, the way I put it is, you just have dignity because you're a creation of God made in His image. You know, I don't need you to tell me I have worth. You know, right. I've already got that. So if you seek it falsely, that's the problem. Seeking false security. So you violate my dignity, but I really want to have a relationship with you, so I'm just going to gloss over that. Hmm. Well, I violated my own dignity by doing that. You know, that's a problem.
Right.
Similar front, avoiding confrontation. I'm just not going to go there with you and say, hey, you just violated so-and-so's dignity or my dignity. I'm just going to skip over it. Claiming victimhood. Mm-hmm. This is interesting. Claiming victimhood. So, we've talked about this with Crucial Conversations, which we have another series on. We'll link to that as well. But if I claim victimhood, I've kind of shut myself down from being able to have a conversation with you to make things better. Because I basically have said, I'm the victim here. You are the one at fault. And I refuse to have any conversation about what part of this I may own.
Right.
That's a problem. Resisting feedback, similar vein, right? Like I'm just not going to hear from you anything that is challenging how I'm approaching things. Blame and shame others to deflect off of me and put it back onto you. That's a dignity violation. And then gossip. Gossip is a dignity violation, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not willing to go to you, but because I need a safety valve on this frustration I have with you, I'm going to go talk to so-and-so. Well, now I'm treating you like you don't matter, and not giving you a chance to own a mistake, and you know that whole clarity is kindness thing mm-hmm. never gets a chance. So those are the temptations to dignity. I think a lot of these are, you know, small aggressions in many cases, and you just think of, you know, Booker T would have had the right to, you know, just absolutely blast people. In some cases, I mean, I think you can almost see like revenge fantasies playing out where he'd want to hurt people.
Oh yeah.
Physically hurt people, right? He got whipped, you know. Mm-hmm. And here in our day and age, it's a workplace violation, like, you know, hey, you know, you didn't tell me directly. But that is still a dignity violation, and it hurts you as well as them.
Oh, yeah. What's interesting about this list is we do an exercise in some of our workshops where we have people brainstorm what are some of the attributes of the best leaders that they've ever worked for.
Right.
Who are the best leaders? And we document all that. And then we've even done the flip side of that is think about the worst boss you ever had. And share with us, no names, but just share with us the attributes of that person. And the flip chart ends up looking like this list of 10 temptations. I mean, there's so many items from that list. You're avoiding confrontation and resisting feedback and shirking responsibility and jumping to conclusions and gossip. It's all in that list. So people know it, right? They don't have Donna Hicks's list. But inside they know this isn't right. This isn't how you treat other people, especially when you're in a leadership role, when you're an authority figure, and you have above average power over people's lives.
Right. And I guess we should have said Donna Hicks came at this from the angle of working with peace negotiations. So she had connections with IRA bombings and Middle East peace negotiations, and I can't remember all the different places she was, but she kept saying, you can't ever deal with folks who want peace. Both sides want peace. They've got the smartest guys in the room sitting at the bargaining table, so to speak. And because of these dignity violations, they have such a long-term, traumatic impact on people. People are truly suffering and hurting, because of these dignity violations, they can't ever have the peace process happen because they haven't dealt with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with these, remember the worst boss you've ever had. Oh, they can remember it. Trust me. Right? Yeah. The suffering continues. They still have some trauma around.
Yeah, you can be talking to somebody near retirement age and their example is from somebody that they worked for in high school.
100%.
And they still remember how this person did not treat them with dignity.
100%.
And it stuck with them 50 years later.
That's it. Exactly it. And so, the good news is that Don Hicks has a list of things you can do to combat this. And it is actually quite easy to combat. I mean it's somewhat simple. It takes some courage. You have to open up, and courage comes from the word heart, the French word for heart, and it takes showing your heart a little bit here, but it is very simple to do. I'll give you the list. Honor your dignity as well as others' dignity. That's one of the things you can do. Mm-hmm. It's an essential skill. Just in other words, follow those 10 elements of dignity. Defend your dignity with skill and humanity when necessary, which is what Booker T did. He's got this book that's just this eloquent retelling of what happened to him without throwing all sorts of jabs. It's just very, very simply telling the story and saying that that was wrong. And, I think there's two sides to this story. Give, receive, and ask for feedback. Pursuing feedback. This is a little bit like mining for conflict, which is one of the Patrick Lencioni terms. But basically, I'm going to make sure that I've gotten from you, is there any issue here? Is there any feedback you can give me on where I've caused problems for you? Resolve conflict with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
That's another one. So in other words, we're going to work through this conflict, but we can do it with dignity where we're honoring the fact that we both matter. And crucial conversations, I think, really points to that. And then the final one is take responsibility for violating the dignity of others. So if you're aware that it happened, then own it and do something to honor the fact that you are aware of that and repair the damage. So that's the list.
Man, resolve conflict with dignity. I immediately thought of, you can disagree without being disagreeable.
That's right.
There's no reason we can't have a civil conversation about all of these things, where we agree and where we disagree. It's wonderful list, very difficult to do in the moment.
Yes.
When the emotion's high and the amygdala is hijacked and you're full on. To be able to, instead of reacting, to be able to choose your response.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that takes practice, and it takes years to get to the point where where I can decide, okay, here's the best way to respond in this moment for the conversation that we're about to have or the situation we're about to deal with.
Yeah, and a lot of what you're saying there, it kind of boils down to, are you willing to have a, well, I wonder if it's still working. It is. Wow, that is so weird when it keeps doing that. We'll edit that out. So you got to do some planning, journaling, thinking. There's got to be some time you dedicate to processing. How did that go this week, this day, to where you get to the place where you can say, okay, I've made a decision. I'm going to go have that conversation that I need to have about my dignity being violated or the dignity I violated in somebody else, or I wonder how they're thinking. I better go collect some feedback. These are things you can do. And again, I want to highlight the reason we're having this conversation at all is because it's not just, oh, that's bad, that's wrong, that's morally wrong. It's, this is deflating the entire organization. You are hurting as much as they are hurting when you cause suffering on treating somebody like they matter. Hmm. If you're treating them that way, it's impacting you, and it's probably impacting you more long term. So, there we go.
Fantastic. Well, in commemoration of our third Booker T. Washington episode, I'm very excited about that. I have for you the authentic United States currency, 1946, Booker T. Washington's silver half dollar.
Wow.
Mark, enjoy.
Well, you talked about this, and I thought it was kind of a joke, but man, and he's such a good looking guy. I don't know if I can show.
He's man candy, yeah.
Can I show this?
Yeah, he's a good looking human being.
But yeah, so anyway, that's really nice of you, Mike.
You're
really
quite
nice
welcome.
Of you. I will treasure this always.
Yes, please do. It's pure silver.
And is it really?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. In the words of the Apple Dumpling Gang, I believe the Apple Dumpling Gang rides again. I'm not sure, but this is a cherished token of a gentleman's affection.
Wow, I don't think that was Tim Conway.
It was Bill Bixby.
Okay,
anyway.
That makes more sense.
The yeah. three people in the audience who knew about that are
yeah,
thinking that's great.
They're anyway. They're close to death.
All right.
They're old.
Okay, I'm cutting it off. We need to let our announcer speak.
All right, take it away, Mr. Wolf.
And that's a wrap. It doesn't take a genius. The blog dedicated to reducing the irreducible. Next time, prime numbers. What makes them so special? Join us then, and thanks for listening.
That's good enough.